What's up, guys? This is the MLB Hall of Pretty Good podcast coming at you with a very special episode, as for the first time in this show's history, we were able to sit down and talk to an actual MLB player. That's right, former Royals catcher Lucas May sat down with the show, and we were able to pick his brain and ask him a few questions about his career, as well as the workings of Major League Baseball. I hope you sit back, relax, and enjoy this conversation with a former MLB player. Lucas May, everyone. All right, everybody, here is former Royals catcher Lucas May. Lucas, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
You got it. Happy to do it.
Thank you. Okay, so my first question would have to be, growing up, did you have like any players or teams that you idolized growing up and maybe you tried to emulate as a young baseball player?
I sure did. So I was born in 1984, so I grew up in the 90s, and WGN was broadcast all over the country. So naturally, I was a Cubs fan, and those Cubs teams in the 90s with Mark Grace and Ryne Sandberg in particular, him and Andre Dawson, those two were my favorites growing up. Ryne Sandberg, power hitting second baseman. He was just a lot of fun to watch. And then I moved to St. Louis when I was in first grade, and became a Cardinals fan, and watching the Cardinals in the 90s as well with Ozzie Smith, and, you know, and then the Mark McGwire era, and all that. I was a big Cardinals fan as well.
Awesome. Yep. I grew up, I've been pretty much a Red Sox fan my whole life, living on the East Coast, but I did watch a lot of Orioles and Nationals games, because being from Virginia Masson, their sports network was something we got with
sure.
Yep. So I remember those Orioles teams with like Adam Jones and Nick Markakis, people that were playing around the time you were playing, obviously.
Absolutely. Yep.
It was a lot of fun to watch them. So you were,
it was a good time for baseball.
It was a good time for baseball, definitely. So you were drafted in the eighth round by the Dodgers in 2003, correct?
That's right.
Yep. So could you maybe walk everyone through what it's like on draft day? Like, did they call you, or did you have an agent at the time? Like, how did it work exactly? I'm just curious about that.
It's dramatically different these days. These days it's on TV. If you're going to be picked in the first round or second round, you're flying somewhere, and it's on TV, a lot like the NFL draft. Back then, what we had to do was we had to sit in front of our computer and listen to the audio feed of the commissioner. I think it was the commissioner, whoever was doing the draft, announcing the draft. So my family and I sat in front of the computer and just waited. And there were some guys going that I had heard of, but the access was totally different. You didn't really know, except from by word of mouth, who big time players were.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of names that going that I had never even heard of. And then no, at the time I did not have an agent. We were sitting there, it was a couple hours in, and finally Tommy Lasorda for the Dodgers gets on, and in his classic Tommy Lasorda announces that they've picked shortstop Lucas May out of Chesterfield, Missouri. And then almost immediately, the person that you talk to is the scout for the team. So okay. that's my contact. So he's the guy who would travel around, watch me play, along with lots of other scouts. But his name was Mitch Webster. He's also a former major league player. And almost immediately he called me, said congratulations. And within 4 or 5 days, I was signed and headed out to extended spring training.
Really? That's so awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I've always wondered how it exactly works for a player when they're drafted and what happens immediately after. That's awesome to hear. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, sometimes you'll get pre-draft calls. I didn't get any that I remember. But sometimes a club will call you and say, hey, we're thinking of taking you as pick number 140. Would you settle for this amount of money if we picked you there? And your answer can kind of change whether or not they pick you. So that stuff goes on as well. There's some behind the scenes stuff.
Okay, cool. And tying into that, you were drafted out of high school as well, correct?
That's right.
Was there a debate between just going straight to the pros after high school, or did you think about playing college baseball? Like, what was your thought process?
There was a debate amongst my family and I. I was signed to play at University of Missouri to go play shortstop there, and I got a great scholarship. In baseball, they don't have full scholarships like on a football team. They've only got 17 scholarships to work with, so I got a great scholarship. But it was always my dream to play in the big leagues and to play professional baseball. And it was an opportunity that ultimately we decided I wanted to just go for it right then and there. So we didn't talk about it for too long. I knew what I wanted to do. My dad knew what I wanted to do. But there was a conversation around it.
Okay, that's awesome. I feel like I never made it anywhere near that, but I feel like I'd be the same way. I feel like the ability to play in the big leagues would be way too hard to pass up, really. And so I definitely
understand. Yep.
And so on my next question, you also said earlier you were drafted as a shortstop, and it looks like you also played some outfield as well, but you then shifted to catching. What happened with that caused you to make that change in your position? Like, what was the reasoning behind it? Was it a decision you made, or maybe coaches in the Dodgers organization made? Like, how did it happen exactly?
Yeah, that's correct. So I was drafted as a shortstop, and I was an above average shortstop as a high school kid, and I played well my first year or two. And then as the game started getting faster, my bat progressed at a high rate. My bat was progressing, but my infield skills were not progressing as much as they needed them to. I was making a few too many errors, 20 or 25 a season, which is a lot. I mean, elite major league shortstops these days make 3 errors a season. It's utterly ridiculous how good they are. But with how well that I could swing the bat, they wanted to find a path. The Dodgers initiated the conversation. They wanted to find a path that would be the fastest to the big leagues for me, so I could help their club. And I had a lot of speed. I mean, I was a shortstop, so I had a lot of speed. So we tried outfield first, and I did well, but I probably could have stuck with outfield. But at the time, all they had was Russell Martin behind the plate. And they really didn't have anybody in the system that was close enough within a couple years to be able to help their big league club. So they approached me and said, "Hey, do you think you'd want to try to get back there? I think that your path to the big leagues would be pretty quick, and I think you could pass a lot of people up." So I just said, "Yeah, sure." I could always go back to the outfield or go to a corner somewhere. But yeah, I jumped on it and went all in on it. And I definitely don't regret it either, because aside from I got to the big leagues as a catcher, it's a fun position, and it's a position that I had not played much of in the past. And you're able to use your brain a lot more. You're in every single play. Cold games, you're never cold because you're catching. So yeah. It was a good move. For sure.
Did you find it to be much more hard on your body physically? Because usually you hear about people moving away from catching and going to like first base or a corner outfield spot. Instead, you moved into being a catcher. Did you find that to be harder on your body as time went on?
For sure. It was harder on the body. But I think one thing that saved me is I didn't grow up doing it. So I didn't have all these miles on my legs squatting. And to this day, I'm still a really capable, healthy guy with no aches and pains in my legs anywhere. So I think that's one thing that saved me. It's not just luck of the draw, though, because it takes a lot of work, a lot of personal maintenance in the weight room, working out small muscle groups, working out big muscle groups. So it's one thing that I just had to learn. I had to learn how to take care of my body. My first year catching actually was an A-ball Inland Empire, and I had lost 20 pounds through the course of that season just because I didn't quite know how to lift yet. I didn't know how to take in the proper amount of calories that I needed to sustain weight and strength. So that was my first year catching. Aside from learning the skill of the position, it was really learning how to take care of my body for the long season.
Got you. Yeah, I definitely would think that would be tough to do, especially as somebody who didn't grow up catching. So you didn't necessarily know all the ins and outs of what to do as far as taking care of your body. I must think that would be a challenge to do.
But certainly.
Any way to get to the big leagues, though.
That's right.
So my next question, it looks like you were traded a couple times in your career. The Dodgers traded you in 2010 for Scott Posednik, I believe. Could you walk us through what happens when you're traded? I know in today's time, you hear about these like almost horror stories of these players finding out they were traded overnight on Twitter or something like that, or X now. But I know back then in 2010, social media wasn't quite as prevalent. So how did you find out? Like, how was the news broken to you?
You're right. The news was not as prevalent. However, in 2010, social media was starting to get some legs. So I don't even know if this outfit is around anymore, but it was called MLB Trade Rumors.
It is.
That's still around?
I check it daily. Yes, it is.
Oh, you do? That's yeah. Funny. It's still around. So leading up to that July 31st deadline, I was named in some rumors, and my teammates were just telling me this because I wasn't really into looking at that stuff. Mm-hmm. But my teammates were like, hey, did you hear blah, blah, blah? I'm like, no. So I was in the lineup. This was in Albuquerque, New Mexico, AAA with the Dodgers. I was in the lineup hitting fourth or fifth or something that day. And about 45 minutes before the game, I was getting ready. I was getting ready to go out to the line and stretch and warm up our pitcher. And about 45 minutes before, Tim Wallach, my manager, calls me in the office. And he's like, hey, you're not going to play today. And I was pissed. I'm like, why? And then Kim Ng, who was an executive with the Dodgers, I don't know where she's at now. She might work for Major League Baseball. But she was an executive with the Dodgers. And he put her on speakerphone. And she was like, Lucas, I just want to thank you for everything you've done for us. But you've been traded to the Royals. We wish you luck and all that. And then that was it. I had to take my uniform off. You got to take your uniform off. You're done. You're not a part of their system anymore. And for that game, I just sat in the clubhouse, watched the game on TV. You can't go out to the dugout or anything. So I had to wait till like my roommates were done so I could take them back to the apartment, stuff like that. So I hung out with the team afterwards kind of one last time because I had come up with them 7 years with the Dodgers, and I was best friends with several of these dudes that were on my team. Mm-hmm. So just hung out with them until it was time to go, packed up all my stuff, and the very next morning I was on a plane to Omaha.
Wow. Was it kind of a bittersweet feeling to leave the Dodgers organization but then also be excited for a new opportunity with a new team?
Definitely. Because the Dodgers do a good job in their system, at least back then, they probably still do, of kind of making you learn the culture, the history of the Los Angeles Dodgers. So I knew lots of people from that organization, past and present. Mm-hmm. But honestly, there wasn't really a lot of time for sappy emotional goodbyes because I was going to be playing the very next day for the Omaha Royals. And it was more exciting than it was bittersweet. Because in the grand scheme of things, you got to be pretty lucky to spend your whole career with a single organization. So, you know, it's almost inevitable that you're going to have new teammates and play for a new club, new name across the front of the chest. So when that day came, it was exciting for sure.
Yeah. I'd have to think I'd probably be more excited than sad because a new opportunity could always lead to new things, which it obviously did for you because you did make it with Kansas City eventually. So that's awesome. Thank you for sharing. So over the course of your minor league career, you hit 109 career homers, including 25 in the 2007 season. So when you went up to the plate, were you looking to always do damage with your power bat, or was it just depending on the situation? Like, what was your approach when you went up to taking a bat?
You know, when I was younger, when I hit all those home runs, I think that the previous year, this was 2005 as an outfielder, I think I hit 18 home runs. The next year, that was 2006. 2007, I hit 25 home runs. And at that time in my career, I was basically just hunting a fastball to try and yank it. Mm-hmm. And at that level of baseball, which is A ball and high A, you don't have a lot of pitchers that can pitch around that because they don't have the control yet. So I would get my fastballs and yank them over the fence. However, the next year in Double A, my first year in Double A, I started off with the same approach. And my first month, I was on fire. I hit 8 or 9 home runs, was hitting 330. And then second time through the league in Double A, now those pitchers, some of them are a phone call away from going to the big leagues.
Yep.
So those guys, they're like, oh, we're not going to throw them that pitch anymore. Yeah. So I stopped seeing the fastball middle in, and I struggled horribly. So I had to adjust my approach. And the coach that was pivotal for me to doing that was a guy, John Valentin. You might know him. He was a former Red Sox guy. I think he's in the Red Sox Hall of Fame. But John Valentin, we called him Val, he took me in one day and was like, hey, are you happy right now? I'm like, no. He's like, well, let's go to the cage and get to work. And he taught me how to drive the ball to the opposite field and how to open up the entire field. And that's the approach that I took with me all the way through the rest of my career. Mm-hmm. And I own a baseball facility now and give lessons every day. And that's one of the main lessons I instill in all my students is the importance of hitting the ball to the opposite field.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I'm always curious as to what people who's made it, what their approach is when they go up to taking that bat. Thank you for sharing that. So in September of 2010, it finally happens. You get the call to the big leagues. Did it happen when the rosters expanded in September? Is that when you got called up?
Yeah, September 1st.
Mm. So how did you find out and kind of what were your emotions as it happened?
It was interesting. So I was in Omaha the final year for the Royals to be in Rosenblatt Stadium, which is where the College World Series was played, and they were building a new stadium for them. So it was kind of our farewell, you know, tour at that site as our home field. And of course, everybody knows September 1st is around the corner and there's a lot of dudes that are hopeful to get called up. So it's no secret that you're wanting the manager to call you in the office. I was in the lineup that night, and if you're going to be called up, usually they don't put you in the lineup because they don't want you to get hurt, right? So I'm in the lineup, so I'm like, okay. So I play. I can't remember how I did. The game was over, come in the clubhouse, and we're eating. Some guys are leaving. I'm eating. I'm taking my time. I'm like, so Mike Gerschle was the manager, and I'm like, is Gersh going to come talk to me? Is he going to come grab me or not? Finally, I throw my plate of food away and I'm about to get in the shower and he comes out. He's like, hey, Luke, come here. I'm like, okay, this is probably it. So go in the office. I had actually just been hit by a pitch the night before on my elbow. And he started by saying, so how's that elbow feel? Do you think you can play tomorrow? I'm like, well, yeah, I can play tomorrow. I played tonight, Gersh. And he's like, well, good, because they need you tomorrow up in the big leagues against the Texas Rangers. I was like, all right, cool. So, you know, same story, packing up all your stuff, making sure you got everything. And Omaha is a drive to Kansas City. You don't fly unless they need you right away. So I was able to pack up my car, pack up my apartment, leave in the morning, the next day, drive. Now, what was really cool about that, when I got traded to the Royals, I lived in Kansas City during the off season. So I had a house there. And getting called up to play for the Royals, what was unique was I was able to drive to my house, wake up, and drive to the park and play.
That's awesome.
So it was a homecoming. It was a dream come true. It's everything that you think it would feel like and more.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. That's so cool to hear about your experience. And so my next question would be, so with spring training taking place as we're currently recording this, when you're not playing spring training games, how would you prepare yourself for the upcoming season? What type of work would you do?
Like during the winter?
Just in spring training.
In spring training. Okay. Spring training is a grind. And I think a lot of players would tell you that they hate spring training, but a lot of fans wouldn't want to hear that. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of true because it's a grind. The whole goal of spring training is it's really separated into two groups of players. There's players that have major league contracts and their jobs are secure. And then there's players that are fighting for a spot. So the routines of those two players can be slightly different. If you are Giancarlo Stanton, you know, or, you know, any, if you're Mike Trout, you're not going into spring training trying to win a job. You're going into spring training to make sure that your body's ready to go for the season. Mm-hmm. Now, for the last kind of 3-4 years of my career, I was the guy in the other group where I was fighting for a spot. So I had my routine. I'd get there at 5:45 in the morning. I'd knock out my personal weightlifting obligations. I'd knock out my hitting with the hitting coach, my one-on-one time with him. I would get my one-on-one time catching work in. So you got to take care of all your personal stuff before the day starts. You usually have a team meeting around 8:45 or so, and the manager, the coaching staff are all present in the clubhouse for that meeting. They map out what we're going to do for the day. Then you go out to the field, you get your team work in, you take your ground balls, you catch your bullpens, you do your live BP, your team fundamental bunt plays, things of that nature. You go in for lunch and you come back out at 1 o'clock and play the spring training game for the day. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, they're pretty good about letting you know when you're going to play. However, I always had the approach that even if my name wasn't in the lineup, even if I was told I wasn't going to play that day, I was always going to be prepared to step in and play at a moment's notice. So if I wasn't in the lineup that day, I was down at the bullpen warming guys up so I'd stay loose. And so I get to know the pitchers. And if I was in the dugout, I was moving around because you never know when someone's going to get hurt and when you got to step in and show everyone what you can do.
Awesome. Yeah, that definitely sounds like a full day of work. It's not just show up, play the spring training game and leave. It's a ton of work that goes into that.
You know, a lot of people think, even people that I come across teaching, during regular season, they think you show up at 6:15 p.m. to get your stuff on and go play 7 o'clock game. You're there at noon, 11:30, 12, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, getting ready. So it's, you know, a normal job is, you know, 9 to 5 or whatever and 8 hours of work. Well, we're putting in 10, 11 hours of work from the time we get there to the time we get in our car and go home.
That takes a crazy amount of discipline and work ethic. That's amazing. I have the absolute most respect for guys like you who are able to do it. That's crazy.
It's definitely fun. It's definitely a lifestyle that, like you said, you have to be very disciplined about taking care of your body, about what you put into your body, and about how hard you work, for sure.
And so I just have two more questions. One of them being, so over the course of your career, you signed a couple minor league deals. How does free agency work exactly? Like what did you go through in that process?
You know what? So minor league free agency and major league free agency they work the same way. Because even now you'll see players signing minor league deals that have been in the big leagues for 10 years. One of my friends, Mike Moustakas, I saw he just signed a minor league deal with somebody. So it doesn't matter where you're at in your career. You could always fall to a minor league deal, or you can get a big league deal. But essentially there's a free agent time, and I forget what the date is. It might even be first day after the World Series. I'm not sure. But you just wait, man. You wait and see what's out there. You wait and see who calls you. I was a minor league free agent 3 times, maybe 4. And those first few, I was a hot commodity as far as catching goes, because I had some time in the big leagues. I was always hitting for power, and teams wanted me. So it was pretty competitive market for me. So I got to choose kind of where I went. And my very last year, I signed a minor league deal with the Milwaukee Brewers. And that free agency season was not like that because I didn't have people calling me. But I didn't think I was done yet. I thought I still had some gas in the tank. So my agent and I had to reach out then to clubs, and I drafted an email and sent it to every single farm director that I could get their email from. All 30 clubs, I sent them emails. And it was just, hey, I'm Lucas May. This is my resume. I'm ready to play. I'm ready to go wherever you want me. I want to be an asset to your organization. Let me prove to you that I can still play this game. And the Brewers called me after getting that. And Gord Ash, he was in the front office at the time with the Brewers. And he's a very to the point guy. And I got a call from a number I didn't recognize. You know, hello, this is Lucas. He's like, hi, this is Gord Ash. Did you mean what you said in that email? I was like, whoa, I sure did. I sure did, Mr. Ash. Yeah. So the Brewers signed me because I reached out to them. And then halfway through that season is when I decided that that would be my last year playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even like you said, when you're, whether you're a hot commodity or you have to reach out to teams, that free agency seems stressful because it seems like no matter what, you're just waiting by that phone or playing phone tag with somebody. Doesn't always seem like
it's absolutely true. Yep. Absolutely true. It's nerve wracking. It can be fun. Those first few years of free agency were fun because people want you, they want to pay you. And then that last year was a little nerve wracking, a little more nerve wracking than the others.
And so my final question, it's a bit of a fun one. So you have a rookie card in Topps 2011. Do you, or do other players, do you guys collect your own cards? Is like, do you own a copy of your rookie card?
I own lots of copies. Yeah, I own lots of copies. Not because I actively go out there and try and get them, but you get your hands on them, you know, every now and then, and you just hang on to them. So I bet every player has copies of their own cards. I'm not super into it. I don't hand them out to people, you know. It's cool to have. It's cool for my kids to look at. Sometimes I'll get cards in the mail for people to, they want me to sign them. And if they send two or three, I'll sign one, send it back, and keep the other two.
Yeah.
you know, that sort of thing. So I do have a handful of them. And there's a couple versions of cards out there that are, it's cool. It's cool to have for sure.
I can't blame you at all. I would do the same thing, and I can't blame any other player that does that as well. Sorry, one final question. Sorry. So for linebacker baseball, you said you teach baseball, and I've also seen that you're big into painting. You're an excellent artist, by the way. I saw a few of
you. Oh, thank you.
Is that, what else do you do, or tell us more about what you do with baseball still for life after you?
Yeah, sure. So I retired from playing baseball in 2014, and for the last 2 months of that season, I was putting feelers out for industrial buildings that I could put a facility up in, because I knew that I wanted to do that when I was done playing. So found a place, put up some cages, started teaching, have grown that business now. I've been doing that. This November will be 10 years, which is kind of cool. But apart from that, you know, I've got four kids, and they're, you know, from 7 to 11, and they're into sports now. So we're shuttling them around. As far as my personal time goes, I love art. I love to paint. I love music. I play a lot of music. And that's really what takes up my time is my kids, my work here at the facility, and then those few hobbies that I have.
Well, that's awesome. Like I said, your paintings really are impressive. I saw them on your Instagram account. They're quite good.
I appreciate that. I do play competitive golf now, actually, too.
Really? I hear of a lot of former players.
Yeah, it's a bug that when it bites you, and I don't know, it's probably just the competitiveness of us baseball players, because all of us would tell you that golf is probably a little bit harder to master than baseball. Although hitting is the hardest thing to do in all of sports, period. To make that ball go in the hole is a whole different beast that is just addicting.
Yeah.
That's my competitive release, because for my whole life being a competitive baseball player, I needed something. So I found some competitive golf outlets that are local. And I take it seriously, not in a sense that I think I'm going to be on the tour.
Yeah,
that's never going to happen. I don't even want that, you know, but it's fun to get out there and play against guys that are better than you, that push you to be a better player. And I think it's just healthy, because a lot of players when they retire, it's a real struggle and they don't really have an outlet. And not that it has to be golf, but I remember coming up through the minor leagues, getting several lectures, if you want to call them, you know, sitting through meetings with former players, and they always preach, you're going to be a former player a lot longer than you're going to be a player, so you better have a plan. So fortunately for me, it's been a smooth transition from my playing career to my teaching career. And it's been a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
That's really awesome that you continue to share your knowledge with people, because it's obvious you have a lot of it from your playing experiences. So thank you for doing that for people.
You bet. It's my pleasure.
Well, that is all the questions I have. I once again just want to thank you so much for doing this. It was really awesome to pick your brain for a few minutes.
You're welcome, Bryce. Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Have a good rest of your day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, guys, there was the MLB Hall of Pretty Good's very first interview. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and I just want to give a huge shout out to Lucas May. You know, he gave me 30 minutes of his time that he did not have to do, and he was also really great at giving thoughtful answers to my questions, and I just really appreciate him doing that. It was fun and quite interesting to pick his brain and just learn what it was like to be drafted or be in free agency or his time in the minor leagues. It was really interesting to pick his brain and just find those things out. I had always had these questions I wanted to ask a big leaguer, and I just can't thank him enough for giving me that opportunity. If you like what you heard and you're still here, I just want to thank you so much for listening. You can look out for a new episode on Sunday, and keep looking out for midweek mini episodes as well. Don't forget, you can find the show on Instagram and TikTok at MLB Hall of Good Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. And I really appreciate all the support you guys have been giving the show lately. It's been fantastic. I'm going to keep this thing going. We're going to keep shining a light on these players that deserve being remembered. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a great weekend. This has been the MLB Hall of Pretty Good Podcast. And once again, huge thank you to former Royals catcher Lucas May. Have a good night, everybody.